tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Because your coffee cup might have words on it. And we hate words when we're getting our coffee, apparently. Why did the Starbucks race initiative bother us as much as it seemed to have bothered us? We're going to talk about that in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and today we're with former Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols. Hello, welcome back.
Good morning. Good to be here.
To see you again. The Strangers Associate Editor Eli Sanders. Hi, Eli.
Hi. Nice to be here.
To see you. The editor of Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher. Hi, Phyllis.
Hey, now.
Hey now. So as I think we all know by now, this week the Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz, received, let's see, scorn, derision, vitriol, is that about, and some ridicule for proposing that his baristas write the words race together on your coffee cup.
And if a customer asks you what this is, try and engage in the discussion that we have problems in this country with regard to race and racial inequality. And we believe we're better than this. And we believe the country is better than this. And if this makes you have a conversation with a customer about the need for compassion, the need for empathy, the need for love towards others, if you can do that with one customer one day, then you're making a significant difference.
He was mocked and lambasted for reasons we will discuss, but he seems prepared for the criticism.
There were some people who said, Howard, this is not a subject we should touch. This is not for you. This is not for a company. This is for someone else. I reject that. I reject that completely because we can't leave this for someone else.
Race talk at your Starbucks. We are live tweeting the show or on Twitter at KUOW. Love to know what you think. Let me ask you, my guests, this race initiative, good idea or bad idea, Eli Sanders?
You know, I like what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said in an essay in Time. He said...
The former pro basketball player.
Yeah, and he had a very thoughtful essay about this, and he said, I'm in awe of his chutzpah, he's talking about Schultz, but I'm also in shock that he thinks this will actually work.
Hmm.
That's basically how I feel. It's asking a lot of low-wage, essentially fast-food employees whose job is to do something quickly, to engage in an extended conversation that is supposed to move the ball forward on race in America, which is a huge topic that we've been working on for 200 years unsuccessfully, and in the space of a transaction over coffee, get somewhere. Nice idea, unlikely to work.
Phyllis Fletcher.
You know, when I found out I was going to get to talk about this, I actively stopped reading essays because I was like, you know, I want to come from my experience. And there are great essays out there about it that I love and had to stop myself from reading. But I use the drive-thru. I think that would be super awkward. It'd be insane. Like, do I just put on my hazards and like, so?
Now we're adding to climate change.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We have another problem. And then I thought, is there any circumstance under which I would participate and welcome this? And I thought of specific Starbucks baristas I've had who I've always wanted to talk to about whatever, just because they seem like cool people, but they're always on to the next person. If they could actually stop down and take a break, and it was one of like my cool people, right? Like one of the people I thought was cool and I wanted to talk to anyway. Under that specific circumstance, I think I would do it. I think. But in the larger scheme of things, there are those among us who've been having race conversations since before we realized we were having them.
Mm.
And it can feel burdensome.
Well, and you are, what would you say, biracial?
Yeah. Right? Well, yeah.
You tell me.
Yeah, I'm biracial. To a lot of white people, I pass for white, and I've had questions my entire life about what I look like and why I look the way I look. And there are occasions when you get this, like, can I ask you something? And you're like, no. Like, I already know. Oh, I don't want to talk about it right now. I just want my coffee or my library book or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this like visceral reaction because historically, as that conversation has progressed, it's become something that you wish you could get out of as fast as possible. So I have that kind of knee-jerk reaction to any suggestion that at any moment I could be like, hey, you want to talk about race? No, I don't really want to talk about it with you right now. And even the phrase talking about race is kind of a euphemism. I was happy to hear in that tape that he said, oh, you know, racial inequality. Okay, well, that's at least, okay, now I know what aspect we're talking about. Are we talking about racism? Are we talking about racial violence? Are we talking about just how we self-identify? What are we talking about?
Talking about diversity in hiring? Are we talking about, you know, and on and on and on?
Yeah, are we talking about you? Or are we talking about me? You know, like, what are we talking about?
Okay, so there's a lot there. On balance, I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
On balance, it sounds like you are a skeptic of,
yes,
of this,
I would say,
as a corporate plan.
Yeah. And especially also given what Eli mentioned about these are people with relatively low power. You know, I would not want one of them to get fired if they tried to engage in this corporate initiative and it went horribly wrong, no matter whose quote unquote fault it was, you know, who said something that set the other person off or who showed their ignorance about a specific area and how did that person take it. And, you know, that is a minefield. But, you know, I would anticipate that Howard considered that already and said, you know, we're just going to try it and we're not going to fire people over it, I would hope.
Greg Nichols.
Well, I am not one to pass up any opportunity to mock Howard Schultz, but
why is that?
just basketball. General.
Does this principle. Have to do with professional basketball and the location thereof?
Let's move on here. I think that there is something here. I don't know that this is the right way to do it, but as a country, as a community, we need to have a conversation about race. If Ferguson had had a conversation about race a few years ago, you know, there may have been a different story written there.
Well, Phyllis pointed out that
in 2001, when I ran for mayor, an African-American man was shot to death by the police. And as I went around the city and talked to people, I found incredibly divergent opinions about what that act meant. In much of the community, the majority community, or the formerly majority community, fine. The police officer was threatened, and that's what happens when you threaten a police officer. In the African-American community, other communities of color, the attitude was very different. It's happened again. It's happened too often, and we need to figure out why it keeps happening to people of color. And so we started something that is actually still going on in the city called the Race and Social Justice Initiative, where we talked about what is institutional racism, what is white privilege. I mean, you can't sit down and say, let's talk about race.
Right.
Because somebody would probably opt for a root canal before undergoing that experience.
This could be a way to raise prices because people would gladly pay an extra dollar to their barista.
Not about race. Yeah. But by the time I left office as mayor, city employees felt comfortable talking about race amongst themselves, with other city employees that perhaps they didn't know and didn't work with, and with the people that they served in the public. And that's a very valuable thing, to be able to talk about it without it feeling like an incredible burden, incredibly threatening. And so I think there is something to it. I don't know that this is the right approach or a successful one, but I'm glad that they're trying.
Okay, so skeptics, Eli and Phyllis, more open to the idea, Greg Nichols, of this Starbucks race initiative, though you're saying,
well,
you're not sure it's the right idea.
We trained all 11,000 city employees in what is institutional racism, what is white privilege, why you individually don't need to feel either victimized or threatened by those words. And we tried that training three or four times before we found one that actually worked without really really damaging people's psyche. But we found a way to talk about it. And that's something this country needs to do.
Well, that could be helpful, too, to know that the baristas have gotten training like what you describe. And I don't know that they've gotten
it. I don't either.
Maybe they have. But I think that's another thing that gives people like the, yeah, like, how do I know that you're going to know even what how to handle it if I am in a different place than you?
Yeah.
And I think that would be important.
Mm-hmm.
I like Phyllis's point about giving the baristas room to step down from, you know, their workstation and actually have a conversation about this, because these are not quick conversations when you get into them at all. You said he was focused on racial inequality, which I think in the current climate and conversation gets us directly to income inequality. And so Phyllis also brought up, what are the things that might get a barista in trouble to bring up? Well, can you bring up as a barista that Howard Schultz was not exactly a strong proponent of the $15 minimum wage, and that the income inequality in King County, say, disproportionately affects people of color. And if you can bring that up, great. What is he going to do about it? Because he has more power than any single barista to push for change on that level.
Okay, in reality, we have so many other things to talk about that I want to move on to, but in reality, isn't it the way it's going to turn? I've been to Starbucks twice this week just to see if I'm getting raced together on my cup. Not at all. In fact, I inquired, and the barista said, yeah, we're not quite comfortable with that. So there's that. So it's this voluntary thing. Write it if you want to. And they have probably a one-sentence, you know, summary. Well, this is Starbucks is trying to start a discussion in America about race. In reality, isn't that going to be about all that's going to be said?
We're talking about it right now.
Yes, we're talking about it right now.
So if people are sitting around the water cooler or the coffee shop and having this conversation, that's something. That's something.
Before we go, I must give a little credit to the irreverent people, because other slogans that people have suggested for coffee cups include Black Coffees Matter, African Americano, Mocha Money, Mocha Problems, No Chai Left Behind, and By Any Beans Necessary. For better or for worse. Laugh or don't, in your car. We're going to be back in just a moment. I just want to leave you with this sound. This happened at the Starbucks annual shareholders meeting on Wednesday at Seattle's McCall Hall. When you think corporate shareholder meeting, do you expect it probably means Jennifer Hudson telling you that you sound like an angel?
Hallelujah. Y'all sound like angels. One more time.
And we'll be right back on KUOW's Week in Review. On KUOW's Week in Review, somebody in the room just suggested that maybe they were singing Hallelujah at the Starbucks annual shareholders meeting because this company's done pretty well. Maybe they just announced the 2-for-1 stock split. We don't know. Phyllis Fletcher from Northwest News Network, Eli Sanders from The Stranger, and former Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels are joining you to make sense of this week's news. And this week, Seattle's mayor proposed a ban on smoking in all public parks. Greg Nickels, you obviously oppose this since you didn't propose it when you were mayor, right?
Well, you know, times do change.
Okay. Yay or nay?
I was a big supporter of the initiative that banned indoor smoking. I don't remember exactly which year, but around 2007, 2008 is my recollection. So we had just kicked smokers out of every building, restaurants, bars, bowling alleys, and the like. And I didn't think it was the right time then to tell them, well, by the way, these big outdoor spaces are off limits as well. It is possible that we've gotten to the point where that is appropriate. I fully support the regulations that are currently in place that say smokers got to stay away from groups and individuals who are enjoying the park.
And that's law right now. They already can't smoke within 25 feet.
Right.
Of other people?
Right. So, yeah, I guess I have mixed feelings about it, but maybe it is time.
But what would make it time? I mean, what's different now from before? Well, it's just like, well, this is step 8 in our plan
social
to
change.
Give them
social,
nowhere to smoke.
Well, no, social change takes time.
Yeah.
Probably a bad example, but recycling. When we offered opportunities for people to recycle their food waste in a different way, composting, the first year we spent educating people. The second year we spent warning people that you couldn't do some of the things you used to be able to do in terms of throwing stuff in the garbage, and now they're enforcing it. It takes some time for social change to take root, become accepted widely, and then I think to become not just guidance, but regulatory or law.
Phyllis, no smoking in Seattle parks, yay or nay?
You know, it's one of those things where, so I didn't even know that you couldn't smoke within 25 feet of another person.
I didn't know that either.
Good to know. Yeah. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about that there's already a law that you can't smoke within 25 feet of a door or window. And I don't know of anyone enforcing that. I don't know of anyone who feels comfortable to go, excuse me, you're like not supposed to be that close to my door or window. Right. And so I thought, well, it seems theoretical to me because it's like, well, OK, so let's say that this were a thing. Would I then call 911 and have them be thrilled to come enforce a smoking law in a park or a smoking rule?
Well, it's not very enforced now, right?
Right. So that I would think, well, geez, is it in theory or is it for real?
Okay, so what's your, before we go to Eli, thumbs up or down on the...
I guess I would say like thumb sideways because it seems okay. Like it doesn't, it seems theoretical.
Eli.
I think one of the reasons it comes up is exactly what Phyllis was pointing out. How do you enforce this 25-foot rule? Police have to come out with a measuring tape. People have moved by the time they get there. How do you eyeball 25 feet? And so I think a part of this is for the convenience of parks enforcement officers and police. They can just say, look, this is a banned activity in this space, period. Don't talk to me about a measuring tape. You just can't do this.
Mm-hmm. But is that enough to make public policy that it be more clear to the enforcers?
That's the question in my mind, and I think in a lot of people's minds. Who is this actually for? And there are some concerns, and you know, people in the city would say this is a paranoid concern, but there are concerns out there that this is meant to target homeless people or people, you know, who's otherwise seen as not desirable in a park. Because if you are found guilty of this more than once, I believe, then you can be kicked out of the park. Or at a certain point, you violate this enough and you're banned from the park. So it's just another way that people could be banned from a park. The city says we're not going to do that. And Gene Godden, who has been
city council member,
who's been pushing this at the council level, says there's going to be some sort of study done of whether this will be disproportionately applied or how to prevent it from being disproportionately applied. So I think that's good. I don't entirely understand why, if 25 feet is enough to keep the dangers of secondhand smoke from bothering someone, why we need to exclude people completely from the parks if they want to smoke. If they keep a distance, it doesn't bother me.
I'm glad you brought that up because one parks official said that smokers diminish people's ability to enjoy healthful outdoor recreation. By the way, I detest smoking. Smoking shortened my father's life, probably my brother's, but my ability to enjoy a park, a Seattle park, has never been diminished by the fact that somebody's smoking in it. If I can smell smoke on the wind somewhere, is it really, have I been that? Has my freedoms been that impinged upon? There are people who, it must be, we know it's addictive because what's it, $10 a pack, and people, you know, spend money they don't have to have maybe for them just a little moment of, sadly, you know, to my mind, but a moment of just relaxation. Mm-hmm. And they can't do it anywhere else. Mm-hmm. On the sidewalk, I can't avoid them. In the park, I can. Mm-hmm.
And I can argue the other side. There are tremendous costs. You talked about personal costs, and then there are tremendous public health costs to people's continuing addiction to nicotine. It's a really disgusting drug.
Yes.
And I don't like it either. I don't like smelling secondhand smoke. I don't like being in a situation in a park, and I have been, you know, and usually I just get up and move myself because it is so awkward to be like, you are doing something that smells disgusting. Yes. Please leave.
True.
Or please go 25 feet away because it's the law.
Yes. I'll tell you when you've
it's
when
really
you're
the law.
In compliance.
Right.
little more.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, this new rule would not apply to vape pens and e-cigarettes.
Because it's vapor and not smoke?
It's vapor and not smoke. But if part of the reason is the pollution, which was one of the stated reasons, you know, there are batteries and heating elements and stuff in this. In these e-cigarettes and vapes. Okay, so I have, it sounds like, are every one of your thumbs sideways?
Yes.
Yours too, Eli?
All thumbs are. Part of the reason is the public health argument, then you should ban vape pens also.
Right. Right.
It should be consistent.
Yeah, the answer to that was, well, vape pens are a way that people are kicking the smoking habit.
And that's very nanny state. Certain, certain types of inhalation are good because we think that you are doing something righteous with your smoking, and certain types of inhalation and exhalation are bad.
Right. Okay, so again, in case you've just joined us, Seattle's mayor is asking the Board of Park Commissioners to ban smoking in public parks. The board doesn't need the mayor. It doesn't need the city council. So voters have no say on this? Is that right?
The board actually has no power to do it. It's the superintendent of parks who could do it with or without the board.
The superintendent of parks.
So I think we're looking for an opportunity for public discussion and perhaps cover.
and cover. Mm-hmm. Can I share one more thing with you? Because I was not completely clear on the difference between e-cigarettes and vape pens. So I Googled difference between, and this is always interesting when you start to Google something and it fills things in. So the number one thing people want to know about is the difference between cold and flu. Understandable. Number two, difference between yams and sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. Number three, difference between then and than.
Oh.
Good question. Number four, difference between ionic and covalent bonds.
Wow.
Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, is leaning over my shoulder. Yes, I really am looking at Google. And we are, by the way, Bond is here because, you know, we're live tweeting the show at KUOW. We're on Facebook, our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and we're going to be right back with more news to make sense of for you on the Week in Review. It was interesting because Eli did it too. You just Googled the same thing.
I Googled the same thing and I get the same progression as Bill, but except that my first result is difference between race and ethnicity. So maybe
it's the Starbucks effect.
Mm-hmm. Maybe
we're having a national conversation, a Google conversation, which is the only one we want to have anymore. This is the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders and Phyllis Fletcher and Greg Nichols. Northwest News Network, the stranger, used to be mayor. Two terms. Right, he's nodding. Let's go to our next topic now. Seattle is about to start imposing its new higher minimum wage on large employers, 500 workers. This week, a federal judge ruled that that also applies to franchises that have, let's say, 10 employees. Fair or unfair?
Fair.
Fair?
If you're asking me, fair.
Now, you realize that 10 is way less than 500, right?
Yes. Okay. But we are talking about franchises, which in total have way more than 500 employees nationally.
Yeah, but you're only banning it individually. So why does it matter how many Subway employees there are in Dubuque?
Because it defies...
Not banning it, but I'm sorry, forcing them to go to the higher wage.
It defies reason and logic and the rules of business that these franchises play by to ignore the fact that they are part of a giant parent corporation, essentially, that sets their menu, sets their prices, basically gives them a business in a box and a lot of support, which is not to say they're not hardworking franchise owners, but it is to say that they are part of a giant, often multinational corporation.
Anybody disagree?
No, I think the more broadly we apply it, the more quickly it will be emulated by other places, other cities, other states, hopefully. And it will mean that people who work in that industry, fast food, lower paid industries, will start getting a living wage.
Hey, treating franchises like larger businesses, fair. Fair and fair. Phyllis?
I recuse myself from this discussion.
You are an editor at Northwest News Network.
Exactly.
So you're going to be impartial and neutral.
Yes.
As it should be.
Yep.
That's the kind of independence that we'll be discussing during the spring membership drive in a few days
exactly. Here
on KUOW Seattle. Okay, fair enough. So let me just remind you that, first of all, this judge didn't say this is fair. The judge said, I can't stop the city from doing this. Their rationale is that franchises have all these advantages that Eli discussed. But the franchises say, counting our benefits, yes, we have I own a Subway franchise. I got 10 employees. I have a well-known brand. Lucky me. I have established recipes and procedures and technology. Lucky me. But don't say I'm a big employer. I'm not a big employer. Like, what are we outlawing here? And some people feel that the city, what you're really doing is just favoring local businesses over franchise by any means necessary. Which, okay, do that if that's even legal, but we're not a large business. I have 10 employees.
Well, the smaller businesses will be carried along as more and more people have the opportunity to work for $15 an hour. Smaller businesses will need to offer better wages in order to be able to hire good employees. I think that's fine. I don't think it's a judge's place in this case to restrict the city's ability
right.
to try and create a living wage structure.
Yeah. Fair or not, the judge said, that's not my job.
And in fact, small businesses that meet the definition will be forced to raise their wages on just a slightly delayed schedule.
Slightly delayed. Exactly. So we're just starting to that climb up toward $15 on April 1st. And two of my guests say it's fair. One of them wisely recuses herself. So, you know, I just said that this minimum wage goes into effect April 1st. That's a couple of weeks from now. And already there's a fight over whether it's hurting us. Since the minimum wage was passed, some Seattle restaurants have closed. National publications, Forbes, the New York Post, Rush Limbaugh, are saying, you see, $15 an hour is a job killer. Many of these restaurants say no, and credit to the Seattle Times for actually asking them, following up.
Yeah.
And the restaurants said, no, we're closing for other reasons, not the minimum wage. But do you think they're telling the truth?
Well, if Rush Limbaugh says it, it's got to be it's got to be fact, right? You know, Washington State has had the highest minimum wage in the country for some period of time. And economically, we are in better shape than many other states. And in fact, the part of the state that is doing the best is the part that has the highest wages. It is more expensive to live in Seattle. It is more expensive to do business in Seattle. But there are many assets that we have and we offer to employers that help them to attract good talent. So for us to be higher, that's great. I applaud the advocates for this because this is something that we need to have a conversation about, like race. Income inequality is damaging our country, our feeling of being a community. And our city
so
is leading the way. Our city is leading the way in trying to establish living wage for
yes.
people who work in those essential jobs that we all rely on. But refuse to pay for, at least historically.
Yes. The question at hand is whether the cost of that is some businesses closing. And do you, because a skeptic would say, look, I'm a restaurant, I'm going to close this business, it's already law, and I've got other businesses, and I've got friends and colleagues in here, I'm just going to say, no, this has nothing to do with the higher wage, when books must be balanced, and of course it has something to do with wages. What do you
think? I don't think the restaurant and restaurant owners who were cited by Limbaugh and the right-wing machine were restaurant kingpins in the city. If you look at the Seattle Times Truth Needle story, the first people they talked to were the owners of Little Uncle, which is a small independent business with no larger motivation to lie, as far as I could tell, about why they would be closing. It okay. doesn't make any sense, at least the theory that you're floating there. Sorry, okay. Bill.
Thank you for that.
Phyllis? I didn't want to hurt. I know how gentle you are.
Any disagreement, Phyllis?
Well, and even aside from the specific examples in the articles, restaurants are known to have a high turnover rate and high, you know, right. Low profit margin. If they can't make it in a year, a lot of times they can't make it. There are all kinds of reasons that restaurants close, and it didn't seem like that was borne out.
Bottom line, in a couple of weeks, minimum wage starts to climb. Franchise will be treated like large employers. Some restaurants have closed and say it's unrelated to wages. All three of my guests are inclined to believe them, and Eli knows that I'm gentle. We will be back with more top stories on the Week in Review. Don't go away. Good question, Phyllis. We're going to answer all questions someday. But right now, we've got a few top stories this week to sort of explain and make sense of. First, I want to tell you a story. I just loved this. And it's a what would you do kind of story. A guy from Burien, lives in Burien, Joey DiGiulio, kept getting emails from people he didn't know about a bachelor party and a groom that he's never met. So he Googled some of the place names and realized, oh, this party's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It turns out, obviously, he had been mistaken for a friend of the groom with a similar last name. He didn't say anything to the emailers. He just kept reading, fly on the wall. Finally, this week, the groom's brother wanted a head count, so he came clean. I'm not your guy. And the groom said, you can still come to the bachelor party. He asked him to attend that and his wedding. The bachelor party's this weekend. A weekend after this, his wedding is May 2nd, and the groom says, this is the city of brotherly love. Any and all are welcome. So, and then DiGiulio went online to tell his story and raise his money to travel from Burien to Philadelphia. First of all, would you ever just sit back and watch the thread, or would you raise your hand and say you got the wrong best man?
I get misdirected emails dozens of times a day for employees of a large insurance company in Philadelphia, coincidentally.
Is it Primera?
It's Philadelphia Insurance, some kind of reseller of insurance, because I own a domain name similar to theirs. And I used to forward emails all the time when they were about someone asking someone for a date or someone trying to get a job. I don't think I've caught up with all the emails related to those things lately. Other than that, I have no time. So having personally been invited to many functions... I've never said, oh, yeah, I want to go. You know, I've never played along.
Wouldn't it be weird and fun to show up at a
bar in Philly? I think they know how to kick it there.
Okay, any other reactions before we
I think it probably helps to know the people involved.
Right.
To fully enjoy the experience of a wedding or a party.
I can see that. Suppose I could see that.
But good for him.
I love how the story turned out so much that I can't really get myself to fault the guy, although it is a little creepy to sit there on that email thread for a long time and not say anything, but he did.
He did eventually. Well, just go to Facebook. Use the names. Go to Facebook and show up. You'll know everything about these people.
Did the other Joey DiGiulio make it to the wedding eventually?
We don't know that. The wedding is a week from tomorrow. And the end of the story is that our Burien DiGiulio, in less than a week, hit his goal of raising $1,200 and is putting any more money raised toward the couple's honeymoon.
Aww.
Aww. That's a meet cute. Okay.
Like Phyllis, I get a lot of emails that I know people don't know me, and they certainly mischaracterize anything I've ever done. So,
that just comes with being a former mayor.
The same experience.
Right.
Greg Nichols, Phyllis Fletcher, Eli Sanders, and you. So let's talk money as they are talking in the legislature. So, Eli, what do they pay you over at the Strange?
No. I was going to ask you the same thing.
Really?
Since it's almost law, Bill, that we share our salaries. Why don't you go first?
Well, I'm a state employee, so you can look that up. But I'm just curious, you know, associate editor, successful newspaper, you've been there for years, what, 100K?
You can look it up.
Oh,
or
see
you can
how
cry.
See how you're like rolling a pencil, a pen in between your hands.
I was actually rolling a roll of $100 bills. That's how well compensated I am.
Eli is very gentle. What he means is it's none of your damn business.
None of your damn business is what's really behind this topic. The state legislature is talking about requiring employers in this state to allow workers to disclose their salary if the worker wants to. The sponsor says half of workers say they are either contractually forbidden or strongly discouraged from discussing their pay with their colleagues, and that this keeps women from finding out that they are being underpaid. If we have the option, should we all tell coworkers what we make for purposes of transparency and disclosure and fairness?
I'm not sure. So I've worked in the public sector virtually all of my career, and so my salary has always been available, published.
And why aren't you telling us what it is right now?
I don't actually recall.
Uh-huh.
But you can look it up.
Uh-huh.
Google it. Google.
Uh-huh.
Our mayor's underpaid. So I think it makes sense for job categories, perhaps, to be published. But I think the idea of each individual's compensation being published, I think does start to intrude on their right to privacy. Having the job category, knowing what the kind of general parameter is and that you and your coworker are in that, I think makes sense. But I get a little uncomfortable if we go down to the individual.
But if you don't go person by person and therefore then gender or race or whatever it is.
And all females at the bottom of the range. I get that. But I still am I'm uncomfortable with the privacy intrusion on the individual.
Should we be that uncomfortable? I mean, will we just look back and go, I remember back when we were uncomfortable and now we talk about it and it's no big deal? Anyway, my original question was sort of thumbs up or thumbs down. Should we all tell our coworkers? Greg is uncomfortable going that specific. Yes, Eli?
Maybe I can say this. I've been in both situations. I worked at the Seattle Times for a long time, and I was in the union there. And so everyone knows roughly what everyone's making if they're a union member, because each job classification has a salary range, and you know, you can sort of figure out based on the years they've been there what they probably started at and how much they've moved up since then, although there was, at least at the time, a portion of discretionary performance pay that the company could just give you. But okay, so I existed in that environment, and I've existed in a freelance environment where no one really knows or cares what I'm making because I'm just me. And then I have my current job now where I'm not going to tell you. And I don't know. I haven't noticed a huge, huge difference.
Well, let me put a face on this. Literally, our Facebook page. We asked you on Facebook. Gracie says, I worked front office at a freight service shop. Found out the guys in the office made $3 more an hour, yet I did much more work than they did. I was furious. They thought it was hilarious.
Oh.
Did she talk to her boss? She says, unfortunately, no. I was ignored. I immediately found a new job with higher pay.
Oof.
And good for her, but this is a real issue, as the sponsor is, you know, is saying. So why is our right to privacy on this score of... Here's how, you make this much, here's how much it is. Why is that so precious that it's worth being...
I don't think this is about the right to privacy. This is about affirming the right of employees to share if they want to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm more curious about the fact that all of us, me included, are uncomfortable talking about our pay. We would rather keep it to ourselves than be transparent, which we usually think is a great thing, to be transparent. Phyllis, I haven't heard from you.
Yeah, so I've, like Eli, worked in both situations also, but I've been in the public sector so long that that's kind of how I relate to it now. And I've had someone at a public sector job hand me a grid of salaries broken down by gender, and that was really useful. You know, the person was able to put it together because we were in a public environment, and I probably could have done it myself also, but I wouldn't have known or thought to do that. Mm-hmm. And it was helpful. And also in one-on-one situations, I have told people what I make because, like you point out, our salaries are public. And in our type of environment, it can help people either get a reality check or advocate for themselves or, you know, things like that. So I've definitely done that.
Why are we so hinky about it?
Because you're afraid the person's going to hate you or feel sorry for you. And I've experienced both.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I work for a free alt weekly, so the image of me fanning myself with $100 bills.
Oh,
I think I'm actually more in the feel sorry for you category.
Right.
Okay, so the state legislature is still discussing this, requiring employers to let workers disclose their salary if the worker wants to, which, by the way, is federally protected. But most people don't know that, so some of these laws come along just to highlight that fact. You mm-hmm. are allowed,
mm-hmm.
but you still don't want to. You don't want to talk about race, apparently, right. And you don't want to talk about money. That's the takeaway.
I'll talk to you about both after the show, Bill.
Let's talk privately about okay. race and money.
Yeah.
Okay, KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to be right back. How quickly? Maybe 75 miles an hour. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with former Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols, the Strangers Associate Editor Eli Sanders, and Northwest News Network Editor Phyllis Fletcher. And a few weeks ago, we told you that Washington State was considering tolls for the 405 HOV lanes that could reach $10. And Phyllis, you wisely pointed out that the tolls probably won't go that high.
Right. At the time, I think we
get a minute. Let's hear you way back then, Phyllis.
They get a range. You know, the headlines latch on to the worst case scenario of that range. And so then, you know, it kind of settles out somewhere around, you know, 4 and then maybe creeps up to 6 and then 8.
Yeah, probably more like 4 to 8. We all nodded our heads in agreement. That's right. Made sense. Well, the rates are in. Maximum $10. For
Sweet.
Example, from Linwood to Bellevue during rush hour. We're talking the biggest distance, the peak time could be $10. It's estimated that, as you say, Phyllis, the typical toll will be more like 75 cents to $4.
Right.
But still, some people have to go from Linwood to Bellevue during rush hour. Is $10...
Rush hour is an oxymoron.
Yeah, yes, it's always rush hour. Is that what you mean?
No.
And
no.
You don't go anywhere.
You don't go anywhere.
Fair enough. Listen to KUOW a lot.
Yes.
Hour for 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 2 hours straight.
Also, I have to remind you, at that time we were talking about 12. That's what they were floating at that time.
Oh.
12 bucks.
Oh, well, okay.
You're bones.
You're vindicated. Is 10 bones fair or unfair to that person who's got to get to the job at that time?
I'm fine with it.
You're fine with it.
Congestion pricing is about recognizing that we have enough concrete out there, and the problem is that we all choose to use it at the same time. And it allows some people, anyway, to make the choice to travel at different times or to pay a premium in order to enjoy the relative congestion-free express lanes.
But if it falls hard on somebody who doesn't have much money, doesn't live close to the job, which can be a luxury, et cetera.
And let's provide transit for them.
Transit. Eli, agree?
I basically agree, although there is, well, a number of structural problems that are making it hard for people like the one you described who lives far away because they can't afford to live in Seattle or, say, Bellevue. And you know what would help that person live closer in?
Afford.
A higher minimum wage.
Ah, okay. Phyllis, any...
So this is, again, where I think about a specific person I know who has a job at a coffee shop and a job at a large big box retailer, and she doesn't have a car. And I almost think once she can afford a car, it's going to be worse if she has shifts where she has to drive during that $10 time. That's going to be tough. So I don't know how she's going to get out of that.
Are you news editor neutral on this one, too?
Yep.
Okay.
But the hypothetical... Mm-hmm. Is it's unfair to someone who doesn't currently have a car.
Right.
Okay. They're not really hit with it. Apparently transit works for her currently, or she
marginal.
Walks.
Marginal. Yeah, it works marginally.
But if we could have a vibrant transit system that gives her other choices and she never has to buy the car, pay for the gas and the insurance...
I think she would
that
love that.
Be,
and that's the part she doesn't control, you know? She would love a transit system that works better.
So yeah. Greg Nichols says, yes, it's fair, plus transit. Eli says, yes, it's fair, plus minimum wage.
Plus transit.
Plus transit. And
and affordable housing, you know, housing close to where you work that you can afford and is decent.
This is getting easier and easier to solve.
Yeah, sounds great.
One more driving note. I mentioned 75 miles an hour. The Washington State House voted this week to allow the state to increase the speed limit on state roads to 75 miles an hour. Good news or bad news? You're wincing, Greg Nichols.
Well, traffic fatalities, I think, are always a bad thing.
Yes.
And the higher the upper end of that speed limit, the more traffic fatalities you will have. That is not opinion. That is fact.
Okay, so keep it to 60 miles an hour.
Keep it something reasonable.
Keep
I don't know if it's 60, 65, 50.
It's currently 60 miles max.
Yeah.
Okay, Eli?
I thought it was 60 to 70.
Well, on interstates, you can go up to 70. On I-90 in Washington State, but this would only affect state roads where the max is 60 right now.
Got it. And this was rejected.
That part of it is the House said yes. It's got to go to the Senate.
Ah,
this could happen.
To 75.
To go to 75. Have you driven from the Columbia River to Ephrata? That is one long straight stretch of state road.
And everyone's going 80.
And everyone's going 80. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have a super strong feeling about it. My boyfriend's from Montana, where, as you know, they used to have very few limits on how you could drive on the roads out there. And people still, I think, a lot of them operate under the old rules.
Yep.
And they do all right. It's a little scary sometimes, but they do all right.
Except for the people who don't. Sorry, those people.
Right.
Yes, Phyllis?
Sorry, those people. Yeah, I was thinking back on, you know, so my grandma used to go 80 from Walla Walla to Prescott, Eastern Washington, all the time. It's like once we got past the prison, and I got to say, the only speeding ticket I've ever gotten was to her funeral, going from Seattle to Walla Walla, and I was doing 80 in a 60, I think, and would have been convenient if I was only doing 80 and a 75, and that was all my ticket had been for. But that's a pretty selfish way to look at it.
Way to honor her.
She wanted it that way. She would have wanted it that way.
Did
you get one of those spotted from an airplane tickets? I got one of those.
Oh, no, I didn't get one of those.
Okay. Phyllis says only 75 miles an hour only in memoriam.
At funerals, yes.
Right. Eli doesn't feel super strong, and Greg says keep it to 60.
It uses more fuel, and it kills more people.
I am not caravanning with you, dude. I'll tell you that. We're not going to Ephrata together, Greg. I'm walking and I'll beat you there.
Yes, you will.
KOW's Week in Review, back in just a moment. Oh, listen, I'm reminded that the state has adopted new express toll rates and rules for that could affect you. If you want to ride for free in the fast lane during peak hours between Bellevue and Linwood on 405, you'll need two passengers. That's going to change. Not two for a carpool, three people for a carpool. Mm. We want to know, how will this affect your commute? Give us a call. We've run out of time to actually discuss this on the Weekend Review, unless you have really super strong feelings about this, more than Eli did for the last topic. Give us a call, 206-221-3663. We want to include your voice in our coverage here. Three people for a carpool. What do you think? How would it affect your commute? 221-3663. Eli Sanders, Greg Nichols, Phyllis Fletcher, welcome back to the Weekend Review. Microsoft joins Rush to Kill the Password. Good headline, Forbes magazine. This week, Microsoft said its upcoming operating system, Windows 10, will support biometric authentication called Windows Hello. It lets you use your fingerprint, your iris, or your face. Biometrics instead of passwords. Good news, bad news.
I'm sitting here watching Greg Nichols with his thumbprint-activated phone, and I'm so jealous right now.
You like that, huh?
Yeah. I'm like, I want to steal that, but oh, then it wouldn't work because I would need your thumbprint.
You'd have to take the thumb, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So two thumbs up for thumbprints, but are you not worried that that's just more data that's eventually going to wind up?
Yes, that's my worry, and it may be misplaced. Maybe I haven't read enough, but my instant worry is, well, okay, you can steal my password, and then you can use it to steal whatever else you want. Okay. But I somehow feel worse if you've stolen my iris.
Yeah. Now, Microsoft says that this iris information, Eli's iris details, will be authenticated on the device, not stored on a remote server. Do you seriously believe that no company will ever get hold of your iris?
No. It's maybe if I wear my fake contacts.
I like it.
Here's just a couple of, okay, so thumbs up, Eli, thumbprint down.
Yes.
Okay, just a quick tip. I have a way of associating a password with a website or an app. Personally, it has to do with popular music. You can invent your own, mm-hmm. but you can come up with ways that you can remember that password if you associate it strongly enough with your bank or your whatever. When I start losing my memory, then I'll have to switch to fingerprints and hope for the best. And one more thing I learned this week talking about this, security questions. I answer security questions as if I were a certain fictional character.
Oh.
So I always know what they're going to say, but I'm not giving up all my elementary school information.
Yeah.
I have a friend who just uses whatever the last word of the security question is. She types that word in, and she always gets the question right.
Wow.
Which is also kind of brilliant. So if you have any more tips.
What?
Yes,
you can always answer green.
Always answer green. That sounds so secure.
And her plan isn't that brilliant anymore because you've now just outed her.
Oh.
To...
Did I give her name?
No. Oh, no!
No, you didn't.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, so two out of three thumbprints up and one and two cautious iris havers on the killing of the password. Producer Jason, how are we doing on time? Can I tell my story about Gene? Okay, last thing. Thank you for coming, by the way, folks. Every week on the Week in Review, we make sense of the top stories, as we should. It's a good thing. We want the news to make sense. But let us not forget the value of nonsense. When I was a kid, there was a TV talent show called The Gong Show. Anybody?
Oh, yes.
Right?
I've certainly heard of it.
Thank you, Phyllis. Well, listen, you know how American Idol, the performers try really hard to be polished?
I don't.
They do. The Gong Show featured people like your weird uncle that no one talks about. And then every once in a while, the host would stop what he was saying and get this pained look on his face, like the ecstasy he was experiencing was killing him. And he would say, "It's Gene, Gene, the dancing machine."
Ladies and gentlemen, our next...
And Gene the Dancing Machine would come out on stage doing a very ordinary sort of average shuffle. But the guest and the crowd would erupt and people would throw rubber chickens on the stage. And it made no sense to me when I was 8. But, you know, a lot of things don't. This week, Gene the Dancing Machine left us. He passed away, and I thought, he lived until now? Because the man did not look healthy, Phyllis, am I right?
Yeah.
And I found that as I was reading, that Gene Patton was a stagehand on the show.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a professional dancer. He was a guy, and I don't know why he was dancing on that stage. Do you?
I heard that someone saw him backstage, and he would start gigging backstage a little bit, and someone thought it was hilarious and was like, why are you doing this back here? We got to get you out there.
Wasn't it surreal and great?
I loved it.
I don't know why he was dancing, and I don't care.
How much did he make?
Question. Former Mayor Greg Nichols, Eli Sanders from the Stranger, Phyllis Fletcher, Northwest News Network. This is your moment of Gene. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us, and join us again next week. Go, go, Gene!